Well, good day, everyone and everywhere. Special greetings to all those seated in heavenly places in Jesus. The name of this broadcast is Cross the Border, and I'm Nicholas. And this is a live Prophecy Reality Edition. For the first hour here, we're going to look at news, current events, a few things that are going on around us. In the second hour, we're going to move on to several additional segments of the audible version of the Horae Apocalypticae, and I am progressing quite nicely on it. I have one chapter left of the first volume. I'm not doing the appendices, of course, but just doing the book, the content itself. But as I said, it would be likely this week I'll be done with the entire first volume of doing the audible, and looking forward to moving on to the second edition. Really been enjoying it this time more than even the prior times that I read it, because it seems that much more of it is comprehensible to me. So, very good reading. Okay. Good to see a couple people in the chat room there. Thank you for showing up, you guys. I do appreciate it. Let me know if there's anything is amiss in the video or sound technical thing of this going on here. I'd appreciate it right away. Okay, let's see. What do we got in news? Oh, one thing I wanted to cover first is I have this queued up in my this is in my email. I got this from Robbie, and he sent me this email. He does a little, a blog and a video vlog. I guess he does it while he's in his car traveling, for work or something. I'm just guessing there because you can hear the road noise and very good to listen to, but, he brought to my attention again what I talked about before, this Supreme Court case that's going to be heard likely this month, very soon. And it's even come to the attention of a few other people. He writes, former Arkansas governor and U.S. presidential candidate Mike Huckabee wrote an interesting post on his Substack blog called "Sit Down, I Guarantee This Supreme Court Story Is Real." Yes, I mean, it's phenomenal to me that a case like this could even go to the Supreme Court. And so I'll read the synopsis here. World Net Daily wrote an article highlighting this interesting post. I think that's where I found it, which is how I found it, he says. Essentially, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case that argues members of Congress didn't fulfill their duties by looking into factual evidence of voter fraud in the 2020 presidential election. Their action of certifying the election without looking into what over 100 members of Congress claimed was election fraud was wrong and unconstitutional. Huckabee explains it may be a long shot, but if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the defendants, the Brunson brothers, who brought the suit from Utah, and then the 2020 elections would be overturned and those who certified the elections held accountable, even barred from serving office. It goes all goes to directly to constitutional issues. That's what it's all about. And with this Supreme Court having overthrown Roe versus Wade on the very same issues, that being constitutional, they have accepted this case to hear it. So that means they believe on the surface there is something to it. Okay? And I believe there's something to it. It's just whether they will have the courage to go all the way through on it. And what decision they will make, well, we can only wait with bated breath to see what happens. He says, this is an interesting story because it would fit right in with the theory of a right-wing backlash, which is what I believe is going on. This is Robbie now speaking. In 2024, One of the key elements of having the right-wing backlash is correcting the fraudulent elections, which most people believe are rigged, especially the vast majority of Republicans. And I believe that it is obvious to most Democrats, you know, except for the delusional wing of the Democrat Party. I'm talking about old Democrats, you know, the ones that the Republicans are what they used to be. And now with Nancy Pelosi, the Marxists have totally taken over the Democrat Party. That's where the backlash comes in. The perceptions of the elections being fixed is needed to validate the authenticity of the right-wing backlash. If this ruling agrees that the 2020 election certification process was invalid, then this would be the catalyst for this to happen. With the party nominations coming up later this year and the presidential elections coming next year, this would be perfect timing for this to happen. He says, we'll see how this develops, but don't be surprised if this case becomes huge soon. So we will be looking for that. Let's see. Here's a link. It's like open the World.Daily. Everybody missed it. Bombshell Huckabee announcement. Supremes could flip 2020 elections. And I'm sure I'll put this in the link in the chat room to this WorldNet Daily article. And you can follow it through to the original and even read the case itself, or, you know, what is available so far. So anyway, that's in the chat room. And you can check it out after the broadcast or whenever you get time. Okay, let's see what else we got. I'm not going to say any more about that until it becomes a news item. So anyway, there it is. It's nice to be aware of it and to see something like this is possible as a redress of grievances still in America. Who knows? We shall see. But it shows that there is pushback. And it shows that resistance is not futile. And we just need to keep up the resistance, all of us protesters. Yes, indeed. Okay, let's see what else we got here in the mailbox. Okay. House Speaker vote, embarrassment indeed. There's enough about that already in the mainstream and alternative media. I don't need to talk about that. Oh, here's one that I meant to talk about last week, but of course last week I took a day off. And it was necessary. It's, you know, home business that sometimes just can't wait. And occasionally it happens right when I'm going to do my broadcast. But anyway, so here we are. Last week I found this article in Rebel News. Vladimir Putin addresses the decline of Western civilization in anti-woke speech. Very interesting. Now, after reading this article, maybe you'll agree with me that even Vladimir Putin would make a better president of the United States than Joe Biden. Because certainly, well, let's read the article and you'll see what I mean. Yeah. Russian President Vladimir Putin says that woke ideology is destroying Western civilization. In a speech on Thursday, the Russian leader condemned far-left progressivism and compared it to Russia's darkest days during the 1917 communist revolution, in which the Soviets... See, he's not a Soviet anymore. That's what he's telling us. In which the Soviets seized the means of production and overthrew the government. Speaking at a plenary session of the 18th annual meeting of the Valdai International Discussion Group in Sochi, Putin and other political luminaries discussed the global shakeup in the 21st century. Putin's speech was translated by an interpreter and uploaded at the Kremlin site. Okay. And he said, we look in amazement at the processes underway in the countries which have been traditionally looked at as the standard bearers of progress. And he means really the real meaning of progress when he says that, I'm sure. And what he's saying is, we look to the United States in the last century, but he's saying the tables have turned in the 21st century. He continues, of course, the social and cultural shocks that are taking place in the United States and Western Europe are none of our business. We are keeping out of this. And really what he's saying is, we don't want this to happen in Russia, what's happening, the shocks that are taking place in Western civilization, the United States and Western Europe. He's right. I agree with him. I don't want it where I'm at. And there are many in Western Europe and the United States that are with me on this. We don't want these woke shocks that are taking place. But the power elite, the oligarchs, the Davos crowd, all of these minions that work for the shadow government that rules the world for the Antichrist, they have their clutches in control of all of these Western nations now. They have purchased their way in. It took them 100 years. But when the overthrow of the United States occurred 100+ years ago with the Federal Reserve coup of the U.S. Treasury, that's when it all began. Then when the dollar became the dominant currency of the world, the fix was in, and we see what's happened, and the rest is history up to this point. He continues, some in the West believed that an aggressive elimination of entire pages from their own history, reverse discrimination against the majority in the interest of the minority, and the demand to give up the traditional notions of mother, father, family, and even gender, they believe that all of these are the mileposts on the path towards social renewal, said Putin, elaborating on the cultural decline of the West in the name of social justice. Listen, he said, I would like to point out once again that they have a right to do this. We are keeping out of this, Putin continued, but we would like to ask them to keep out of our business as well. We have a different viewpoint, at least the overwhelming majority of Russian society. It would be more correct to put it this way. Has a different opinion on this matter. We believe that we must rely on our own spiritual values, our historical tradition, and the culture of our multi-ethnic nation. The advocates of so-called social progress believe they are introducing to humanity to some kind of new and better consciousness, he added. Godspeed, hoist the flags, as we say, go right ahead. The only thing that I want to say now is that their prescriptions are not new at all, Putin continued, and highlighted the similarities between woke progressives to the Soviet revolutionaries who took over Russia. What he's saying is, this already happened over here, and we've thrown it off 100 years later. No, thank you. We lived that, and we don't want to live it again. But go ahead and see how that works out for you. Yeah, absolutely beautiful. Yeah. So he continues, it may come as a surprise to some, but Russia has been there already, he said. After the 1917 revolution, the Bolsheviks, yeah, we know who they are in America, don't we? Relying on the dogmas of Marx and Engels, also said that they would change existing ways and customs, and not just political and economic ones, but the very notion of human morality and the foundations of a healthy society. The destruction of age-old values, religion, and relations between people, up to and including the total rejection of family, we had that too. Encouragement to inform loved ones. All this was proclaimed progress and, by the way, was widely supported around the world back then and was quite fashionable, same as today. By the way, the Bolsheviks were absolutely intolerant of opinions other than theirs. This, I believe, should call to mind some of what we are witnessing now, he said. Look at what is happening in a number of Western countries. We are amazed to see these domestic practices, which we fortunately have left, I hope, in the distant past. The fight for equality and discrimination has turned into aggressive dogmatism bordering on absurdity. Have we seen any absurdity in recent history? It's all becoming so absurd. When the works of the great authors of the past, such as Shakespeare, are no longer taught at schools or universities because their ideas are believed to be backward, he said, the classics are declared backward and ignorant of the importance of gender or race. In Hollywood, memos are distributed about proper storytelling, how many characters of what color and gender should be in a movie. This is even worse than the agitprop department of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. So he's liking it to something that was in existence during the USSR age, which he apparently is saying is over. Is definitely over. Countering acts of racism is a necessary noble cause, but the new cancel culture has turned it into reverse discrimination, that is, reverse racism, noted Putin, who apt went on to describe the woke obsession with race and gender. The obsessive emphasis on race is further dividing people when the real fighters for civil rights dream precisely about racing differences and refusing to divide people by skin color, said Putin in reference to Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech. I specifically asked my colleagues to find the following quote from Martin Luther King. I have a dream that my four little children would one day live in a nation where they would not be judged by the color of their skin, but by their character. This is true value, he said. However, things are turning out differently there, he added. By the way, the absolute majority of the Russian people do not think that the color of a person's skin or their gender is an important matter. In context, of course, each of us is a human being. This is what matters. And he goes on. And very interesting. Did I put this link to this in the chat room yet? Oh, this is Rebel News. Anyway, so if you want to finish reading this article, you can look it up on Rebel News, or you can get the link in the chat room there and finish reading it for yourself. Post it on your whatever. All of these articles, post them on your social media. And continue to spread them around, because these things need to be done. Now, we all know that, that the propaganda in the mainstream media and coming out of the, White House and the Uniparty, composed of both Democrats and Republicans, is pushing the narrative that Ukraine is good and Russia is bad. Now, I've looked at this thing every which way I can, and I know that this war didn't start this year. It actually started eight or 9 years ago, during the Obama administration, when they helped to overthrow and topple the, democratically elected government in the Ukraine and install this actor. Yeah, the present president of the Ukraine, who is basically a Zionist Nazi. Yeah. And they started to persecute the Russian people that were in Ukraine. And you can see it's going on now. They've outlawed the Orthodox Church, anyone who spoke Russian, and half the people in the country were Russian, and they were crying out for help. Before that, Russia was happy to leave Ukraine alone. They had no interest. But when Russians and Russian speaking people and Russian Orthodox religious people started to cry out because their own country was committing genocide on them, you know, the they felt they had to do the right thing, just as America used to, maybe, perhaps in some areas of the world, did the right thing. Okay? And they weren't reaching out way on the other side of the world like the Empire of Washington, D.C., which is really part of the empire that rules the world for the Vatican. And I've got an article on my website about that, and you should check it out. If you go there, you'll see it in the middle. It says Empire of the City, the Unholy Trinity that rules the world. And Washington, D.C. is part of that empire. Unfortunately, the American people get the blame for what the Antichrist is doing through his city, Washington, D.C., because it is definitely a city. Read the article there. Then get yourself a copy, or go to, if you're at my website and you read this article on the Empire of the City here, if you go to my Bible study page here, and you'll see the link right there above the article, it says Bible study. And on that Bible study, there's something that says links, and the very last section has links. And you'll see at the very bottom, Rulers of Evil, F. Tupper Saucy. If you're unaware about the Empire of the City and how the Antichrist and his shadow government, because everybody looks at, oh, the Pope, he can't be ruling the world. Well, he's not really doing it. It's his shadow government, the shadow government that works for the Antichrist, and he is there now. The Vatican is right where that shadow government has wanted to bring, because there was a time when the shadow government that, which is headed by the Jesuits, basically, were banned for this very reason, because of their international intrigue. They were kicked out of most all of the nations of Western Europe at one time for that very intrigue. And, they were even banned and supposed to be disbanded. But the Pope who did that died mysteriously, likely by the poison cup. And of course, the very next Pope installed, kind of the way our, you know, all important elections this in these days are installations rather than elections, like speaking of the present pretender in chief, they installed another Pope, which immediately, you know, reinstituted the Jesuit order so that they could carry on their work of ruling the world. And for a very interesting article on that, well, Rulers of Evil will get you going anyway. So anyway, if you want that, I'll put that in the chat room right now. Copy link. Oh, I didn't do that one. So let's do the Rebel article. And then we'll do here, Rulers of Evil, Tupper Saucy. Download the PDF yourself, because it may disappear one day, and that could happen. Anyway, we're going to go into a break here. So you're listening Across the Border on our Prophecy Reality Edition here on FirstAmendmentRadio.net. So don't go anywhere. I'll be back in a few minutes.
Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust, I will not be afraid. Behold, God is my strength.
Years ahead of the dominant media, FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net.
The book of Revelation says, the spirit of prophecy is the testimony of Jesus Christ. This is at the very heart of FirstAmendmentRadio.com. In that spirit, we have created the Prophecy Reality News app for all of your mobile devices, streaming First Amendment Radio 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, available for your Android device and smartphone absolutely free. Get the Prophecy Reality News app installed today so you can listen to First Amendment Radio wherever you are. The Prophecy Reality News app. Get it now.
The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening. The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our Listen and Schedule pages on the Internet. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back. You're listening to Across the Border. This is a live Prophecy Reality edition. Thank you all for joining me today. In this segment, I was just looking at an article here. Davos Man Cometh, and he is a technocrat. And of course, we have here a picture of a face that everybody has become familiar with, although it's a much younger face, unless he's dyed his hair recently. Anyway, yeah, he doesn't look that young anymore, I can tell. He seems to be aging quite rapidly here. But, you know, if I was responsible for, millions of deaths and the incapacitation and suffering of billions of people on the planet, I think I would have shriveled up and died already. But this man likely has a seared conscience, so... It has to wear on him regardless, if not keep him on the brink of insanity. And you can tell they're insane because of who they think they are and what power they think they have by the money power, the deceitfulness of riches. They think they can pull off their scheme to change the world, but they are not gods. They are destroyers of the earth, and their father is the devil. And Satan, yes. And our good friend here at Technocracy News says, this is a worthwhile read from start to finish. Yes, the world needs to send Davos man, Klaus Schwab et al., packing before he gets his hand around your neck. And believe me, they're trying very hard in everywhere they can. They want to kill you with poison, with a bioweapon that you will voluntarily take into you. And if you won't take it voluntarily, they'll find some way to coerce you. If they cannot arrest you with the police, hold you down and jab the shot into your arm. That's what they would like to do, because they want to kill most of the people on planet Earth. As this man, as you heard it come out of this man's very mouth, that he said, if we do a really good job with vaccines, we can reduce the population. And it makes me very angry that he even got a go at it, and they're still pushing it, him and all of his Antichrist cohorts in the governments across the Western world. Okay, World Economic Forum is a long, and its long-serving founder and executive chairman, Klaus Schwab, are subjects of many insane conspiracy theories. Really? Insane? I think, they're insane conspiracy theories, and they are the ones conspiring to bring their insanity about. That's what I believe. This NGO, which is again this January, these people never give up. They got lots of money. They can keep really busy with a lot of money, touting climate change or whatever they have to do to subjugate every single individual man, woman, and child on the planet. And they won't stop until that's what they achieve, but they will never achieve that. They only think they will. Oh, they may get a lot of people to bow down to them. But, yeah, no masks, no tests, no vaccinations for me. Thank you, Eric. Yeah. So they will be meeting again this January together with politicians, business leaders, journalists, academics, and assorted celebrities in Davos. Has been accused, among other things, of being a secret cabal of pedophiles who used the COVID-19 pandemic to harvest children's blood so as to hasten in the satanic New World Order. Of course, a lot of that is very, outrageous. I don't think that any of these people took the shot. This guy here especially. He would say he did. He might even, him and all his friends, probably many of them even showed up on camera to do an op where they are pictured getting a needle. And some of them obviously were not getting a needle jabbed into them. It was all phony. And it even showed in the video that it was obviously phony done. But they'll all say, oh, no, well, I couldn't take it in public because I already took it in private. Or whatever. That's always their excuse. But see, there is a test. And if you take this test, it will tell if you actually took the shot or not. And this test is called, I forget what it is, but I learned about it from David Knight. Because David Knight had heart problems in the past. He had a heart attack once, if you didn't know that. So he knows about it. He says that when they test you, one of you in the audience may know the name of the test, but it tests your blood for micro blood clots, ones that do not appear, unless you look for them. And so there's a test for that. And then there's a substance that your heart excretes. And I think that's a different, I think it's the D dimer for the micro blood clots, but there's another one that they give you that because your heart excretes a substance or some kind of hormone or a substance if your heart is damaged. And that's the test that everyone who has taken the jab and not got a placebo, I must add. So if you've taken several jabs, it's likely you got one of them was the real jab. because I think they stop the placebos after a while, or maybe they just mix them in. So there's always people going out there, around out there going, I took it and it didn't bother me at all. Yeah, I'm a believer. I feel great. Yeah, saline doesn't bother you at all. But anyway, there is evidence to back that up. The theory about it, why the saline showed up in some of the shots, is debatable, but that's part of the debate as to why some of the shots were saline solution, not just in one place in the world, but in several places over the whole planet. Oh, here, my phone is ringing. Yeah. Let's see if anyone's going to talk to me or not. Your name and where are you calling from? You're on the air.
Hi, Nicholas. Fireman Mike, Akron, Ohio.
Hey, Mike.
I'm on the subject of these big names getting their vaccination.
Yeah.
And, I'm a retired paramedic, and when you give a shot into the muscle of the arm, you insert the needle, and then you're supposed to pull back on the plunger.
Uh-huh.
And you're looking to see if any blood comes in to the barrel of the syringe, because an IM shot is supposed to go into the muscle and not a vein.
Okay.
And I noticed that when a lot of these celebrities were getting their vaccinations, the nurse was just inserting the syringe and pushing it right away.
Yeah.
If they weren't pulling back on the plunger to make sure. So I kind of thought that was a little strange. But anyway, I saw that several times. So I just thought I would point that out.
Do you know the name of that test for heart damage?
I'm sorry, say it again. The connection is real bad.
The name of the test for heart damage.
I'm really having trouble hearing you now. I'm sorry, pal, you're breaking up, so I'm going to let you get back to work.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. All right, well, there it is. The phone actually works, but the connection is bad. But anyway, you can look it up, the test they do to see if you had a heart attack, because the damage shows up. But I did hear that everyone who has taken the jab tests positive for heart damage. So what we need to do is when we get these guys lined up for their Nuremberg trial, we need to give them all the tests to expose them as the liars they are. I mean, some of them may have had heart damage in the past, but I think the heart damage has to be ongoing. And with the shot, it would be ongoing, and I don't know how long it's ongoing, but it eventually kills many people, as we saw several more football players drop dead. Well, one's in a coma. In an induced coma right now. He's unlikely going to survive from what I hear from some medical professionals, that it is unlikely that he will survive, because they did CPR on him for 9 minutes and then put him in an induced coma. They say he's likely brain dead. Well, I guess if you're in an induced coma, your brain is at least not functioning, it would seem. So it's an ongoing thing, and people will continue to drop dead, because I believe this is the design of the bioweapon that's masquerading as a vaccine, okay? And I'm not afraid to say it anymore. I'm not on YouTube either, and that's why I'm not on YouTube, because I will say it. We'll always speak the truth, no matter what the cost. I don't care about popularity. It's just unfortunate that if you speak the truth, you get shadow banned, and First Amendment Radio is one of the first to be shadow banned. Our shadow banning started in 2008. Moving forward, it has been horrendous on First Amendment Radio, on every channel, on every search engine. We are the last people you will find. So I figure it this way. If you're listening to First Amendment Radio, if you found us, it's only by the grace of God. That's it. It certainly isn't by the hand of any man, myself or otherwise. Your name and where are you calling from? You're on the air. Well, I guess our ghost caller had to jump in there, heard the phone ring. Well, at least he's still listening, whoever he is, and we're all praying for you that your eyes will be opened and that you will come to the saving knowledge of Christ, to our ghost caller. It looks like Scooby-Doo's in the chat room there. Thanks, Dale. Yeah. Wow, I think that's it, right? Okay, so anyway, the Davos man cometh. Is he a technocrat? Let's see. It isn't mad, however, to regard the WEF as a dangerous force in global politics. The WEF is a dangerous force in global politics. You had to repeat that, I guess. To adapt Joseph Heller, just because you are paranoid does not mean the WEF isn't after you, because they are. A shared distrust of the WEF brings together anti-capitalists on the left and culture warriors on the right, but that distrust is based on a misunderstanding of what the WEF is these days really all about. For many, the WEF critics, the vileness of the organization can be encapsulated in one word, neoliberalism. It's a term that conjures up images of plutocrats and untrammeled markets ravaging the planet and exploiting blue-collar folk in the name of profit. Funnily enough, Chairman Schwab agrees with that assessment of the world's ills. Once upon a time, the WEF prioritized the necessary benefits of economic globalization. That has not been the case for many years. However, in October 2020, Schwab stated that, shibboleths, okay, I don't know what that word is, of our economic system will need to be reevaluated with an open mind. Chief among these is the neoliberal ideology. Free market fundamentalism has eroded worker rights and economic security, triggered a deregulatory race to the bottom, and ruinous tax competition. Precisely how and where free market fundamentalism has run amok remains a mystery. After all, we live in a world in which most governments in developed nations routinely control 40% or more of their nation's GDP, nor does the regulatory welfare state's relentless growth in, say, the European Union, Britain, and America, suggests that free market radicals have been in charge in Brussels, London, or Washington for decades. As for China, since 2008, its Communist Party leadership has been steadily reasserting state control over an economy that was only ever very partially liberalized. Ignoring these inconvenient facts, Schwab believes that the world needs a great reset. COVID, according to the WEF website, explaining the global reboot waiting the world, revealed all the inconsistencies, inadequacies, and contradictions of multiple systems, from health and financial, energy and education. The entire planet needs a new social contract to reshape the future state of global relations, the direction of national economies, priorities of societies, nature of business models, management of global commons. That's quite a list. Yeah. A key concept of Schwab's vision of a reset world is stakeholder capitalism. And we are not the stakeholders, people. And they believe they've already found all their stakeholders. And, of course, Bill Gates is one of them. And anyone who can be instrumental in repressing the liberty of the people. And basically, you can go back and you could read another document on the establishment of the shadow government itself 400 or 500 years ago. And you can see that wherever riches accumulate, the shadow government operatives are there, because they know that if they cannot take over those riches in the generation existing, that with patience, the patience of an organization that is multi-generational and has been working on this project for 400 or 500 years, they will eventually gain control. If not in the generation it has control at the moment, they can weaken it in ways, or force it out, or rob it, or they could get the next generation to turn that those riches over to them, or to their control at least, for their purposes in the world. And this is how this organization has worked for 400 years. They have instructions that were written 400 years ago on how to achieve this. And they have been implementing these instructions for those 400 years. Okay. And those instructions have changed and adapted with the times, of course. So if you read the 400 years old instructions, they may seem a little out of date, and they are, but that does not mean that they have not adapted to with the times, to the modes and all of the ways that they are working in the world now through the riches of everyone. And only, you know, it's like this guy here, right there, you see him at the top there, his picture there. If he was not willing to go along, if he was not a willing participant, then they would take him out. They would move him away from his riches. You know, they set up foundations where to keep this money for generations, to where to grow this money, and how to use this money to shape the world in the way that they want. And they think that they have power, but we know that their power is worthless against the true power of the universe. And the tables will be turned on them soon enough. But I just thank God that, as he said, he will have them in derision. And they are in derision. Yeah. They think it should be smooth. They think by the deceitfulness of their riches, they should have their way. And the deceitfulness of their riches makes them think that they are more than they are, when they are actually less than the smallest man that is justified by the blood of Christ. By comparison, these people, these stakeholders that the World Economic Forum refers to, are worms. And it will be worse than worms. Yeah. And also, they knew that the toxic bioweapon was a poison, because they helped to roll it out, and they would not take it themselves, because, yeah, they want to reduce the population, but they do not want to be part of the reduction. Yeah. And so they would notify their own families, you know, and if their own family insisted, well, then they'd send them to their doctor. But, yeah. Or they'd have to expose their evil and their murder to even loved ones who would object. Yeah. You think about the lies that these people have to live with, even in the presence of people that they love, that would not be of the same mind as them. Yes, God judges each one of us individually, and we all die and meet him on an individual basis. We meet him every day individually. Most ignore him, but those that acknowledge him will be rewarded, because he is a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. Okay, well, let's see what else we got. I think you could check out that article. That's at technocracy.news. That's yesterday's article. That's the date of it anyway. Okay, let's see. What else do I got here? Okay, we did that one. We're not going to go there. Let's see what else we got. Flashback, executive order on ensuring responsibility. Oh, yes. The CBDC. Yes, flashback. Executive order on ensuring responsible development of digital assets, namely CBDCs. And, yeah, I'm starting to take checks now. And I think I'm going to, we're weaning ourselves away from electronic money here. The cost is great, but I'm hoping it doesn't cost us more than the minuscule amount that we operate on already. But, because we still have, I think we got, I might as well put it out there, we got $8,000 on PayPal last year, about $8,000 on PayPal. and with a few other donations that are mailed in, not to minimize any of those that are giving, because they all give sacrificially, I know, especially if they're walking with Christ as we're walking with him. But the CBDCs are on the rise. 2030 is still their target date. I still don't believe that they're going to get uniformly over the whole earth. Their system, their Mark of the Beast monetary system, implemented everywhere. I believe one of the greatest pockets of resistance is the one that they're trying to tear right down right now. That's why they've given the kill shot, mostly in the Western countries. And they're importing people, and they don't care if they get the shot or not. They can come in, you know, in Western Europe and the United States. And it's all, they're all, yeah, either Islam or Latinos, both, you know, both the same church. She is the mother of harlots, and one of her harlots is Islam. Yeah, there's a history there too. You can research that for yourself, how the Roman Catholic Church or Vatican, you know, we're speaking not of the people, but of the church corporation, how it created Islam in around the when it was created 8th, 9th, 10th century, whenever it was begun there, and over several centuries came to prominence in the world. But it is another creation of the great whore church, the great anti-Christian church. Of course, that's all she can produce, is she is corrupt to her core. And as the reforming fathers or reformers discovered, that she is beyond redemption. Yeah, that's it. She is that great apostasy spoken of by John, and which the others of the prophets named as ruling in over the earth and overcoming the saints during a period of 1260 years. Well, that 1260 years came and went, and she went into hiding for a while, and she was reduced so wounded that she finally lost all the governmental power over the nations for a short time, but they have stealthily creeped back in to where they have regained control of almost the entire earth. Okay, I'll be back after the news and some messages, so don't go anywhere, and I'll introduce the several segments that are coming up.
Program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening. Hear it first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net.
Okay, welcome back. We don't have much time. This is part 17 and 18 of my audible version, and the third seal and the fourth seal of the Revelation according to E.B. Eliot's Horae Apocalypticae. So let me get this audio going right away, and I'll give you a slideshow to enjoy while you listen to it here. Horae Apocalypticae, Volume 1, an historicist commentary on the Revelation, updated and revised for the 21st century, derived from the original work of E.B. Eliot. Read by yours truly, Nicholas Arthur. Part 1, Chapter 3, The Third Seal. Continued. Let us now, as under the previous seal, compare the history with the prophecy in respect, first, of the fiscal evil itself, as causing the dark color of distress, at the time prophetically indicated on the emblematic horse, second, of its administrators, as signified by the horse rider, and words addressed to him from the throne. Number 1. Now, as regards our first point of inquiry, the historic epoch well accords, of course, with the chronological position of the hieroglyphic before us, following closely, as it did, on the era of the introduction of the military despotism depicted under the second seal, and preceding that of the mortality under Valerian and Gallienus, the subject, as will soon appear, I doubt not, of the fourth. Further, another point of agreement will be obvious in the identity of the articles of produce on which the Roman taxation fell with those noted in the vision. For the former, like the latter, comprehend both corn produce, including wheat and barley, and also, from such of the provinces as best produced them, wine and oil. And let me add that the system of the largesse, as about this time acted out on a large scale at Rome, they were all, or nearly all, included, and so must be the evil aggravated that we speak of. At first it was otherwise. For a long time corn only was distributed to the citizens, the largesse of oil given on one occasion by Julius Caesar was an extraordinary donative, and not repeated. Again, when Augustus was petitioned to supply them with wine, he declined. In the reign of Septimus Severus, however, father to Caracalla, the largesse of oil was again accorded, after a short intermission under Elagabalus, the donative renewed and established by Alexander Severus, not very long after which wine may perhaps also have been granted to them by Aurelian. So that the time to which I refer, the voice in the vision, not only were all the four items of taxation mentioned in the vision regularly in requisition from the produce-paying provinces, but three out of the four had received aggravation from the system of largesse above mentioned, as did soon after the fourth also. "We shall be too often summoned," says Gibbon, "to explain the land tax, the capitation, and the heavy contributions of corn, wine, oil, and meat, which were exacted from the provinces for the use of the court, the army, and of the capital." What Gibbon here alludes to is given with reference, more particularly, to the times and financial system of Diocletian. But, as before observed, there is good evidence of this oppressive branch of the Roman fiscal system having been in operation throughout nearly the whole of the half century from Caracalla's decree to Diocletian's accession. As to the state of the Roman people as affected by the evil spoken of, and its accordance with the black color of the horse, the sign of distress and impoverishment in the body politic, it has already been observed on and is equally evident. Indeed, in the graphic descriptions of Gibbon, the very trope of the black color of this third horse is adopted, just as of the white and red of the two seals preceding, to illustrate the effect of the evil, with reference both to its earlier and later operation, he speaks of the dark prospect of distress and calamities bequeathed through Caracalla's profligacy to his successors, and how this fiscal evil, as a noxious weed, sprang up again with the most luxurious growth, and in the succeeding age darkened the Roman world with its deadly shade. Unquote. Number 2. Nor, I think, as designative of the agents in these oppressions, whom I suppose the rider of the black horse to have represented, in other words, the provincial presidents, proconsuls, or procurators, to whom, as to the praetors and quaestors of the old republic before them, was now entrusted in each province with the collection of the produce and the revenue. Will the apocalyptic twofold indication here given be found less characteristic? I mean, the indication, first, of the words addressed to the black horse rider from the throne, secondly, of the balance held in his hand. As to the words, it was obvious respecting persons in offices like those of the provincial proconsuls that, as opportunities abounded for exaction, more especially in respect of payments in kind, or of purchases in kind, when extra supplies, as was often the case, were required by the sovereign government at Rome, so unless rigorously checked, abuse of those opportunities was likely to follow. In early times, this forced itself on the notice of the Roman Senate and people, and precautionary laws were enacted by them, laws adopted and added subsequently by the emperors. They were styled laws de repetitious, or against extortion and injustice on the part of the provincial governors, and in their general charges against injustice well corresponded. It will be observed, with the tone and spirit of the monition to the writer in the text. Besides which, and with the same object of preventing injustice, particular precautionary provisions were sometimes, in other laws, made against it, especially by naming the price at which the governor was to rate and purchase. I may cite as a specimen of the Cassian Frumentarian law. And really, the expressions in it are so remarkably similar to the words pronounced in the apocalyptic vision, so illustrative of their perceptive and admonitory character, and of the object and meaning in that character of the charge they contain as to the price of corn, as to seem like an actual comment of explanation on them, it having been enacted at the instance of Cassius that 800,000 modi of wheat should be bought for the citizens of Rome by the provincial authorities. The price to be paid for it, about the fair market price at the time, was by the legislating supreme government enjoined upon those authorities, in a phrase brief and simple, like that in the text, a modus of wheat for a denarius. Such was at that time the admonitory direction of the supreme law and government at Rome to the provincial authorities. Such was the naming of the price of corn and the object of it. Nor was the case different afterwards with any of the truly justice-loving emperors, whether urging the thing with a successful effect, like Trajan and the Antonines, or, like Alexander Severus, less successfully. And how did such monetary laws arise? Surely, forasmuch both these and the general laws against extortion were conceived in the spirit of equity, they might well be considered as emanating not only from the subordinate earthly powers ordained by God, but from Him, the habitation of whose throne is justice and judgment, and who has solemnly declared Himself in His written law against all defrauding, oppression, and wrong, even the same that in the apocalyptic visions sat enthroned in the midst of the living creatures, God Himself. For, as Hooker beautifully says, of law there can be no less acknowledged than that her seat is in the bosom of God, a truth which even the heathen Romans had acknowledged. The price of wheat named in the Cassian Law varied indeed greatly, as will be seen, from the one here mentioned, the former being a denarius for a modius, the latter a denarius for a coinix, or eighth part of a modius, that is, if we follow the most natural hypothesis about the coinix, and suppose the common Attic coinix to be the one intended. But it is to be remembered that as time went on, and the Republic passed into an empire, and the empire became settled and mature, great changes took place in the price of corn throughout the Roman Empire, under which circumstances changed proportionate, of course, occurred in the amount of price equitably dictated to the provincial governors in the laws of equitable emperors, at which to estimate, to buy, and indeed also to sell. Of the average price at the period not very long before the apocalyptic vision, we have seen already authentic record in the elder Pliny, who died A.D. 79, 2 years only before Domitian's accession, stating it as then about 3 denarius, the modus, or 3 times greater than in the age of Cassius. This price would seem to have continued pretty much the average through the prosperous times of the 2nd century, after which it declined till it stood at just half Pliny price under the Constantinian emperors in the first half of the 4th century. And on the reasonable hypothesis of the decline having progressed nearly about 1/3 at the opening of the 2nd quarter of the 3rd century, the date of the reign of Alexander Severus, the average price at that time might have been about 2 denarii and a half for the modius of wheat, or near 1/3 of a denarius for the Attic coinix. But how, then? The price is still altogether at variance with that enunciated in the apocalyptic vision, a coinix of wheat for a whole denarius. Hence, in truth, at first sight, a great difficulty. Indeed, for a long time it seemed to me insurmountable, on the hypothesis of the Attic coinix, and I fell back in consequence on the supposition of the larger and less common coinix of 8 cotylae being meant as its best solution. But I had overlooked one most important element for the consideration in the question, which at once sets all right, vis-a-vis the intrinsic value of the denarius at the time supposed to be depicted in the vision. For so it is, and I now find that though the denarius for centuries previous, under both republic and emperors, had been always scrupulously coined of pure silver, yet, from the commencement of the 3rd century, it began to be gradually more and more adulterated, to the value of 1/2 in the reign of the 1st Severus, and in the reign of the 2nd Severus, to the value of just 2/3. So that, as under the last-mentioned prince, the denarius had but 1/3 the silver, and consequently but 1/3 the value of the older and standard denarius, the apocalyptic charge, a coinix of wheat for denarius, proves to have been the literally true expression of about its average price at that particular era. Surely the coincidence must be deemed very remarkable. As to the price of the barley specified in the voice from the throne, it is considerably lower than its usual proportion to that of wheat, it being but 1/3, not as more commonly 1/2, but there does not seem to be here anything in our hypothesis inconsistent with historic probability. Alexander Severus's large and celebrated procurations of corn in considerable measure accounting for it, since these were doubtless most by far of wheat. Let me observe, before passing from this subject, that the apocalyptic specification on the denarius as the standard money price, in the voice from the throne, may perhaps have been common at Rome, as language borrowed from the Cassian law, a price involving the specification also of that small wheat measure, the coinex, rather than the modius. But chiefly, I conceive, this is specified to indicate how low the taxation would descend, and consequently its universal oppressiveness. And let it be understood that the idea that measures thus small might have been specified as well as larger, and in the Roman laws of that period, is not the mere conjecture of the expositor, with a view to suit the language of the prophetic figuration before us. There is still extant direct historical evidence that such was the case, in record both of measures and weights, and as an object of the very careful and serious legislation, with a view specifically to that which we have explained as the intent of the voice from the throne, the protection of the tributaries of the empire from unjust extraction on the part of the extractors of tribute. So in a law of Valentinian, which orders small standard measures as well as the larger modius and corresponding weights also to be placed in every city in order that every tributary might see whether more was extracted than his due, and punishment follows surely on the fiscal exactor. Moreover, somewhat remarkably, an ancient weight of 2 pounds, just equivalent to the coinex measure of wheat, has been lately made the subject of critical examination at Rome, one stamped, it seems, as a government weight under the direction of one of the market overseers of Alexander Severus, and issued doubtless with the same equitable object in the view as Valentinians, as well as for the general use of buyers and sellers in the market. Thus is the specified price and measure, as well as all else, found to suit our view of the rider in the third seal, though with special reference, insofar as regards the apocalyptic voice as from a throne, to the reclamation of the law of equity under Alexander Severus. And indeed, I cannot but think that to St. John those words enjoining the price of wheat and barley must almost of themselves have suggested imperial provincial governors as the parties addressed under the figure of the rider, just as the monitory words of the Cassian law might in earlier times have suggested the provincial administrators of the old republic, more especially as there was added that other monition, in the same spirit of equity, about the wine and the oil, precisely the like to which seems to have been enjoined from time to time on the provincial presidents by the more justice-minded emperors, in connection with the imperial exaction of wine and oil, in their canon frumentarius. If, however, of itself, this indication might appear insufficient, the second and additional indication of the rider's holding a balance would, I conceive, then conjoined with the former, have sufficed to set all doubt aside on the point. For the balance, from being the emblem of justice, came to be an official badge of those that were appointed to the administration of justice, such as the praetors at Rome and the provincial governors in the provinces, which latter, accordingly, under the old republic, used sometimes to have a balance over the cruel chair of their high office, on coins struck in connection with their appointment, and, together therewith, sometimes also an ear of corn, or it might be a Roman measure, with reference to the procuration of corn charged more or less directly upon them, just as in the metals pictured above. In imperial times, indeed, the supreme judicial and financial as well as supreme military power, centered in the emperors, whence the ascription to them of the balance of justice, whether in historic writings or on imperial coins, such as that of Alexander Severus here, with the legend, Equitas Augusti around it, but the authority that the balance indicated, as well as that indicated by the sword, was delegated, of course, by them to their subordinate provincial and financial governors, just as in other times. And another country, it was said by Henry V to the English Lord Chief Justice, hold thou still the balance and the sword. Which being so, and the two apocalyptic indications of the figured balance and the monitory voice as from the throne against injustice in regard of corn, wine, and oil, being thus conjointly characteristic and distinctive of a Roman provincial governor, on which to go forth publicly to his province, as well as to the military proprietor, so that in respect of the black horse rider, as well as of the rider of the red horse, the apocalyptic emblem might be considered as one drawn from life. And now I think we may draw to a conclusion. We have seen what were the charges to equity addressed to the provincial governors, and their very badge of the balance might seem almost a profession of equity. But they were professions from Caracalla's time, the earliest included in our vision, with few and brief exceptions almost always falsified, and the injunctions of the law to equity, however solemn, for the most part altogether in vain. Those, says Gibbon, who had learning enough to read the orations of Cicero against Verus, might instruct themselves in all the various arts of oppression, with regard to the weight, the price, the quality, and the carriage, and the avarice of an unlettered governor would supply the ignorance of precept or precedent. Unquote. The robbers of the provinces was both Severus's and Aurelian's just appellation of them. Moreover, as in the wide-extending branches of fiscal administration, they acted out this mockery of justice, so also in the judicial and general administration. Hence the solution of the enigma, which at first sight seems scarcely explicable, how, under the influences of one that held the balance of equity as his badge, the aspect of the Roman horse, or people, should yet gather blackness. For it was but an official symbol and profession that he held the balance of equity. The reality of the case with him, as with Ephraim, was that described by the prophet. The balance of deceit is in his hands. He loves to oppress. The voice of natural equity indeed never, even from the first, ceased its reclamations, and by Alexander Severus, as we saw, there was, in a very remarkable manner, a waking up of the voice of law in support of it, even as by one who had studied and loved the golden precept of Christianity, do unto others as you would have done unto yourself. But it was all in vain. After brief and partial amelioration, the evil triumphed as before. Throughout what remained of the 3rd century, the laws against extortion and injustice, like many others which meet the eye in history, must be looked on rather as records of crime than preventives of its commission. And does it need that I impress upon my readers a sense of the gravity of the evil? With characteristic forethought, the great Trajan likened the undue enlargement of the taxation, with the exacting procurators to collect it, to the morbid enlargement of the spleen in a man's body, causing atrophy. And after Severus's vain attempts at effective amelioration, the history of the sequel illustrates too fully the truth of Trajan's comparison. The general internal wasting of the Roman state resulted from it, as I have already stated from Gibbon. The agriculture of the provinces was insensibly ruined, and thus preparation made for famine, which, as we shall see under the next seal, soon succeeded. In fine, in its not very remote consequences, it involved both the depopulation and desolation of the provinces once the most fertile in the empire, and also personal and family distress, such as to reduce the inhabitants to despair and to banish from the provincials every sentiment of patriotism. Thus, by anyone that considers the end from the beginning, this epoch of Caracalla's decree cannot but be regarded in the same light in which it has been delineated by the historian, as one of the introduction of fresh and grievous morbid principle into the Roman body politic, under the working of which it would indeed gather blackness. And who then can doubt but that it was a subject deserving prefiguration? Or who, that it was the very subject prefigured under the seal before us? For surely, I may say, not a particular is there in the emblematic vision that has not been shown to have had its correspondence in the features, as noticed by me, of this period of Roman history. In truth, brief as is the description of the figuration in the text, the whole subject of this long chapter seems to pass embodied before us as we once again read it. When he opened the third seal, I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on it having a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice, as in the midst of the living creatures, saying, a coinix of wheat for a denarius, and three coinix of barley for a denarius, and see that thou wrong not in regard to the oil and wine.
The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.
Horae Apocalypticae, Volume 1, an historicist commentary on the Revelation, updated and revised for the 21st century, derived from the original work of E.B. Eliot. Read by yours truly, Nicholas Arthur. Part 1, Chapter 4, The Fourth Seal. And when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice from the fourth living creature say, Come. And I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And his name that sat thereon was Death, and Hades followed after him. And power was given unto him over the fourth part of the earth, to kill with the sword, and with famine, and with pestilence, and by wild beasts of the earth. There is no research needed here to explain the intent of the prefigured symbol. The writer was not, as before, the representative of human functionaries and rulers, whose distinctive emblems, though well understood at the time, might now require investigation to unfold them. It is a symbol of meaning as obvious to the reader now as it could have been then to the seer, for the age it meant is expressly told to us. It was the personification of death, to mark that it was the actual king of terrors, and not, as otherwise it might possibly have been construed, the destroyer merely of political existence. His badge, so to express it, is said to have been Hades following him, the recipient, with his opening jaws, of the victim slain by death. The commission was given him by the supreme arbiter of life and death, to kill upon the Roman earth with all the four sore judgments of God, with the sword and with famine and with pestilence, and with the wild beasts of the earth. And the horse, symbolizing the Roman Empire and people, appeared deadly pale and livid under his influence, a hue symptomatic, apparently, of approaching dissolution. An era of terrible mortality, and to an extent scarce precedent in the annals of human history, was here evidently prefigured. The question for us is, was there then such an era in the Roman imperial history, and one following on that of the seal preceding, as we might expect it to do, shortly after the time of the second Severus? The answer is soon given. An era in the Roman history commencing within 14 or 15 years after the death of Alexander Severus is so strongly marked by coincidence in every point with this terrible prefigured emblem that interpreters who explained the first six seals of the history of pagan Rome one and all agree, I believe, in referring the fourth seal to it, by Mead and Abbuse, and after them by Lohmann, Bishop Newton, and others. Passages have been quoted from ancient authors well descriptive of its multiplied miseries. For my own part, having specified Gibbon's testimony so much as my authority in illustration of the former seals, I wish to do the same, though not exclusively, on this one also. And after all, who is so graphic an illustrator? Who like him for extracting the spirit of contemporary history and infusing it, concentrated, into his own painting? He speaks then of the period from the celebration of the great secular games by the Emperor Philip, A.D. 248, to the death of Gallienus, A.D. 268, as the 20 years of shame and misfortune, of confusion and calamity. He speaks of it as a time in which the ruined empire seemed to approach the last and fatal moment of its dissolution. He depicts the various agencies of destruction consuming it. The sword. Every instant of time was marked. Every province of the Roman world was afflicted by barbarous invaders and military tyrants. The sword from without and the sword from within. Famine. Our habits of thinking, he says, so fondly connect the order of the universe with the fate of man, that this gloomy period has been decorated with inundations, earthquakes, uncommon meteors, preternatural darkness, and a crowd of prodigies, fictitious or exaggerated. Of none of these fictitious evils, let it be observed, was there any notice in the apocalyptic vision. But a general famine, he adds in a correspondence, with that which had been predicted, was a calamity of a more serious kind and still expounding our prophecy, though now, retrospectively, that of the third seal. He observed that it was the inevitable consequence of rapine and oppression, which extirpated the produce of the present and the hope of future harvests. Yet again, the agency of pestilence had been prefigured. Accordingly, though little aware in what track he was following, he goes on to notice this also. Famine, he says, is almost always followed by epidemic diseases, the effect of scanty and unwholesome food. But other causes must have contributed to that furious plague, which, from the year 250 to the year 265, raged without interruption in every province, every city, and almost every family in the empire. During a part of that time, he adds, 5,000 persons died daily in Rome, and many towns that had escaped the hands of the barbarians were entirely depopulated. And could we venture to extend the analogy of Alexandria, where statistical tables were kept, to the other provinces, we might suspect that war, pestilence, and famine had consumed, in a few years, the moiety of the human species. Truly, the history must be allowed to agree thus far with the prediction. If the prophetic emblems were terrific, the facts of history of that period were even more so. It seems to me not undeserving of remark that in the secular or centenary game celebrated by Philip, whence this era of mortality had its commencing date, solemn sacrifices had been offered, according to custom, to Pluto, or Hades, such was his Greek appellation, whereby to ensure the preservation of the Roman Empire. And what was the response in God's providence? Behold, a livid pale horse. And his name that sat thereon was Death, and Hades followed after him. And power was given him to kill on the Roman earth with sword and with famine and with pestilence and by wild beasts of the earth. There is just one of the destroying agencies mentioned in the vision that is passed over without notice by the historian, that of the wild beasts of the earth. But though unnoticed by him, it is not unillustrated, for it is a well-known law of nature that where the reign of man fails, that of the wild beasts begin, and that they quickly occupy the scene of waste and depopulation. God said to Israel, I will not drive out the inhabitants from before thee in 1 year, lest the land become desolate, and the beasts of the field multiply against thee. In fact, we have it on record that at an epoch of some 20 or 30 years after the death of Gallienus, their multiplication had risen to an extent in parts of the empire that made it a crying evil, said Arnobius, about the year 296. Thus does he specify wild beasts as one of the plagues with which the land was then afflicted, and of which Christians, as if such evils had never happened before, were upbraided as the guilty cause. But this, as I said, was written in 296, 20 or 30 years after the date of Gallienus's death. And the question suggests itself, what was the state of things during the intervening period? And can it also be classed under the prefiguration of the fourth apocalyptic seal? A good question, this quite necessary to attend to, as I date my fifth seal, not until the year 303, and the rather, as it has been asserted that the whole interval was one so markedly of restoration, not destruction, as to be directly contrary to, and not in accordance with, the symbolization of the seal before us. The answer to this question involves, of course, an historic review of the period intervening, more especially up to the notable epoch of Diocletian's quadripartition of the empire, A.D. 292, which I regard as the included terminus of the fourth seal. It shall be given as briefly as possible. A fuller abstract has been given elsewhere. It is to be understood that after the Emperor Valerian's disastrous capture in the sixth year of his reign, A.D. 260, by the Persian king Sapor, leaving Gallienus, his son and associate on the throne, sole emperor, Gallienus's wretched character induced surrections and rebellions so frequent and universal that the rival assumers of the purple during the next 12 or 14 years are designated by Pollio and other historians as the 30 tyrants. Of these, the larger number were mere ephemeral emperors, but three stand out prominently as having for several years served three great divisions of the empire, from the central empire under Gallienus in Rome and Italy, vis-a-vis Odenathus and Zenobia, from A.D. 260 to 273, in Syria and the east, Aurelius, from A.D. 260 to 61 to 268 in Illyricum, and Posthumus and then Tetricus, from 258 to 274 in Gaul, Spain, and Britain. Such was the empire's mutilated internal state at the time of Gallienus's death in March 268, and on the election of Claudius, the first of the five restoring emperors, as his successor. On his election, the cry of the Roman people and Senate to him was, "Save the empire." Aurelius's own soldiers opened the way to this by assassinating him at Milan. Then came the news of a terrible Gothic invasion. Claudius wrote thus on his road to the Senate. 320,000 Goths have invaded the Roman territory. The whole republic is fatigued and exhausted. The strength of the empire, Gaul and Spain, with Britain too, are usurped by Tetricus. And the archers of the east serve under the banners of Zenobia. In a great battle fought near Naissus in Dardania, the legions at first gave way, oppressed by numbers and dismayed by misfortunes, until Claudius's generalship decided the victory in his favor. Still, the Gothic war continued, and was diffused for a while over the provinces of Moesia, Thrace, and Macedon, then at length repelled within the mountain tracts of Hamus. There the pestilence made havoc among both Goths and Romans, as the sword had done before it, and, among its Roman victims, A.D. 270, cut down Claudius himself. Had the destroyer Death yet resigned his commission to kill with the sword and with the pestilence on the Roman earth? The armies chose Aurelian for his successor, the second of the restoring emperors. A bloody and doubtful conflict with the Goths was the first act of his reign, followed by a peace, of which the most memorable and important condition was Aurelian's final abandonment to the Goths of the great province of Dacia. Next came an Alemanni invasion of Italy, one as alarming as that of the Goths before it. Three great battles ensued, in the first of which, fought near Placenta, the Romans suffered so terrible a defeat that the immediate dissolution of the empire was apprehended. Then the Sibylline books were consulted at Rome by Aurelian's order. But all too late, cried a voice in the Senate House, for the salvation of the Republic. It is like a sick man who only consults the physician when beyond recovery. At the same time, those walls of larger circuit were traced out round Rome, which still capture the stranger's eye by their solemn grandeur, in order to the temporary defense, if so it might be, of the otherwise defenseless mistress of the world. In the two subsequent battles, however, Aurelian conquered. The actual dissolution of the empire was prevented, and Aurelian proceeded to reunite the empire, those vast separated numbers that Claudius's letter made allusion to, of Gaul and Spain in the west and Syria in the east. He effected each and either object, but only through the means of two bloody civil wars. And having done so, and triumphed at Rome for his victories, he set out to repel a Persian invasion, A.D. 275, and on the march, near Byzantium, he was assassinated by one of his generals. In the course of Aurelian's sad, though splendid reign, let me ask again, has death ceased to kill with the sword on the Roman earth, or had the empire cast aside its hue of threatening dissolution? But what next? Says Gibbon, the strength of Aurelian had crushed on every side the enemies of Rome, but after his death they seemed to revive with an increase of fury in numbers. In the year next following, we read of hosts of the Alani that spreading themselves over Pontus, Cappadocia, Cilicia, and Galatia, traced their course by the flames of cities and villages, but who were at length repulsed by the emperor Tacitus, and then of that emperor's sudden death, likely by assassination, and also the assassination of his brother and successor Florian. Then of the election of Probus, the third of the five restoring emperors, who set himself, says Niebuhr, to rescue the empire from the wretched condition in which he found it. First came the deliverance of Gaul, oppressed by invading armies of Franks, Batavi, Burgundians, and other barbarians, who, since Aurelian's death, had ravaged that great province with impunity, then a successful inroad into Germany, and a peace, of which one of the conditions, to which Gibbon calls attention,
was that the barbarians should supply the Roman army with 16,000 recruits, for, he says, the infrequency of marriage and ruin of agriculture had affected the principles of population, and not only destroyed the strength of the present, but intercepted the hope of future generations. Next came the revolt, and successful marauding expedition round the whole maritime coast of the empire, of a colony of Franks settled by Probus in Pontus, then the revolt and defeat of Saturninus, one of the most distinguished of the Roman generals in Egypt, then the rebellion and defeat of Bonosus and Proculus in Gaul. So at length, in the year 281, all enemies seeming to be vanquished, Probus, like Aurelian before him, triumphed at Rome, and, like Aurelian, was immediately afterward assassinated. A poet's idyll, written on Carus's election thereupon to the imperial throne, expressed his ardent hope that this new emperor might be the heaven-sent instrument of putting an end to the then-existing era of affliction and mourning, banish war to its proper abode in Tartarus, and bring back white-robed peace and justice. Had death, in his view, ceased to destroy on the Roman earth, even under Probus? Or the empire assumed a healthful or joyous hue? The shorter reign of Carus was marked by the repulse of the Samaritan invaders of Illyricum, and an invasion of Persia, successfully, probably, but of which the details are uncertain. What is, however, certain is that Carus, in some mysterious manner, there met his death, whether lightning struck or by assassination, and that the Roman army then returned homeward. This was near the end of 283. Then civil strife ensued between three several candidates for the empire. Numerian was murdered by Aper, Aper by Diocletian, who, in a great battle fought in 285, near Margus in Moesia, defeated and slew Carinus, and secured the empire to himself. Thus began a new and memorable era in Roman imperial history. Judging the weight of the whole empire too great for any one emperor, Diocletian formed the plan of dividing it. So in 280, he began by its bipartition between himself and Maximian, and in 292, completed his plan by a quadripartition, Galerius and Constantius being added in the east and west, respectively, as the two Caesars, in association with the other two senior emperors. Just previous to this quadripartition, Maximian had success in some battles with barbarian invaders in Gaul, but been unsuccessful in a battle with Carausius, the usurper of Britain, whom, in fact, he and Diocletian were forced to acknowledge. Said Eutropius, it was while Carausius was in rebellion in Britain, and Achilleus in Egypt, while the Quincagintani were harassing the African provinces, and Narses, the Persian king, making war on the eastern frontier, that Diocletian made Maximian, Hercules, Augustus, Constantius, and Galerius, Caesars. Nor does Eumenius, in his panegyric addressed in the year 297 to Constantius, give a different picture of things as that which in 292 existed in the western provinces. In fact, he compares it with the disgraceful state of the Republic under Gallienus. Mamertinus, in his previous panegyric of 289, had declared the reign of famine and pestilence to have continued down to Maximian's accession in 286. After this, however, a real and more effective restoration of the empire began, only in its new form. So I have brought down my historic sketch, as proposed, from Gallienus's death, A.D. 268, to Diocletian's quadripartition of the empire in 292. And now let me once more repeat my question. Had death yet vacated
his seat of power, or given up his commission of killing over the Roman earth with the four several agencies of sword, famine, pestilence, and wild beasts. It is precisely at this closing epoch of the period under review that Arnobius gives us his very illustrative testimony, already in part cited, to the truth of the fourth apocalyptic seal. Quote, "Men complain. There are now sent us from the gods pestilence, droughts, wars, scarcities, locusts, hail, and other things noxious to men." And then he asks, "But was it not so in ancient times also?" Again, "If every species of corn be now devoured by locusts, or if flood destroy the human race, was it not so before? Were there not wars with wild beasts, and battles with lions, and destruction from venomous snakes before our time?" Very striking seems to me this picture of the empire in 296, with its distinct and particular specification of all the four evils mentioned in this seal, and very striking its contrast with Tertullian's picture of the empire's cultivation, population, and prosperity about a century before, shortly after the ending of the prosperous period of the first seal. Indeed, could there be a more direct contrast? I must now advert to one point of marked apparent difference between the prophecy and the history, that in the prophecy, death's destroying commission might seem to be expressly limited to the fourth part of the Roman earth, whereas in the history of the period just reviewed, from A.D. 248 to 292, his devastation extended over it all. But let the reader well remark that if the prophecy differ from the history, it differs from, and is also inconsistent with itself, seeing that the whole horse is depicted with the death-like hue, not its fourth part only, besides that the whole tenor of the prophecy seems to mark this seal's evil as the climax to the evils of the two preceding seals, to which no such limitation is attached. What then is the solution of this difficulty? And can we find one probable in itself, and that shall reconcile the prophecy alike with itself and with the facts of the historic era? After much consideration and reconsideration, my mind has turned more and more to that very remarkable reading in Jerome's Latin Vulgate, to which Mead long since called attention, and De Bus after him. Super quarter partes terra, over the four parts, instead of the fourth part of the earth. The genuineness of this, as Jerome's own version, and not any mistake of a later copyist, is indubitable. And since his faithfulness to the Greek text is as unquestioned as his critical judgment in choosing between various readings in it, it follows that he must have had before him some correspondent reading in one or more Greek manuscripts of authority, though our extant Greek manuscripts do not exhibit it, and which he deliberately preferred, as of all the best. As to what that reading was, I cannot but think that Mead has rightly conjectured it, for my original objection against this, as a word that would require a plural genitive to follow, I find to be invalid. And supposing it to have been Jerome's and the true Greek reading, the comparatively unusual form of the expression would perfectly and easily account for copyists substituting for it the more common. Admitted, this reading makes the prophecy at once consistent with itself. As applied to history, what it requires is that the Roman Empire, at the time predicted, should have had some kind of quadripartition. Will, then, our historical solution bear this new and trying test? Turn, reader, and read the answer to this question in the fact of the then three great divisions of the empire from the central or Italian fourth, those of the west, east, and Illyricum under Posthumus, Aurelius, and Zenobia, respectively. Just that same quadrant partition, in fact, which was soon afterwards adopted and legitimized by Diocletian, and which, as I may hereafter observe, was in a measure the original of that other famous apocalyptic division, of which we read in the first four trumpets.